Hello, everyone. This is a poetry podcast with Sally and Paula, and we are here at FATV Studios looking forward to sharing a really interesting afternoon of poetry. Hello, Paula.
Hi, Sally. It's great to be back.
It is indeed. I'm going to get my headphones adjusted. So we have, we're going to start way back in time. So what's our theme this week? We should have a snappy title for this.
I know. It's really about young poets or youth and poetry. And we have some great poems and some information. I think we probably have more than we can use in one podcast session because the whole idea of poetry and young people and just how important young, youthful voices are. It's a really interesting and compelling theme for one of our sessions, or several. So let's get started, Sally. I know you have a poem from centuries ago, but it's pretty compelling.
It is indeed, and I think that one of the themes is actually the theme of prodigy. You can be a musical prodigy, you can be a mathematical prodigy, you can be a chess prodigy, and the rare, rare person is a poetry prodigy. We're going to conclude with someone who is a true poetry prodigy of the 21st century, but we're going to start in the 18th century with one of my favorites, a fellow named Thomas Chatterton. His dates are 1752-1770. He was a really bright young man, and he was raised in Bristol, England, and he impressed a lot of people very early on. He was exceptionally studious. He had a mother who basically ran a school. His father died when he was an infant. And he was in a school where the emphasis was reading, writing, arithmetic, and catechism. So he was really fascinated with the church, but he also was fascinated with science. And unfortunately, he encountered some failure in that his political writings, failed to kind of get attention, and he poisoned himself at the age of 17. And there's a very famous Pre-Raphaelite painting showing that, like showing the death of Thomas Chatterton, which was really considered a seminal moment in the neoclassical era, which was going to give way to the Romantic era. So Chatterton is a very romantic poet who lived in the time of the neoclassical. This is a poem called The Copernican System. The sun revolving on his axis turns and with creative fire intensely burns, impelled by force of air, our earth supreme rolls with the planets round the solar gleam. First, Mercury completes his transient year, glowing refulgent with reflected glare. Bright Venus occupies a wider way, the early harbinger of night and day. More distant still, our globe terraqueous turns, nor chills intense, nor fiercely heated burns. Around her rolls the lunar orb of light, trailing her silver glories through the night. On the Earth's orbit, see the various signs, mark where the sun our year completing shines. First the bright ram, his languid ray improves. Next, glaring watery, through the bull he moves. The amorous twins admit his genial ray. Now burning through the crab, he takes his way. The lion flaming bears the solar power. The virgin faints beneath the sultry shower. Now the just balance weighs his equal force. The slimy serpent swelters in his course. The sabled archer clouds his languid face. The goat with tempests urges on his race. Now in the waterer his faint beams appear, and the cold fishes and the encircling year. Beyond our globe the sanguine Mars displays a strong reflection of primeval rays. Next, belted Jupiter, far distant gleams, scarcely enlightened with the solar beams, with four unfixed receptacles of light, he tours majestic through the spacious height. But farther yet, the tardy Saturn lags, and five attendant luminaries drags. Investing with a double ring his pace, he circles through immensity of space. These are thy wondrous works, first source of good, now more admired in being understood. I think that is the first poem I've read that's all about the zodiac, that's all about the moving planets. And you can tell the state of telescopes at the time, because Jupiter has bands, and they see that. And he mentions four of the 12 planets, and mentions five of the moons around Saturn. Then, and of course, that's where the universe ends, because we didn't have Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto until later in the 18th century, early 19th century, and beyond. But I like Chatterton a lot. I mean, he must have been such a brat.
Well, and it's interesting that he wrote about the zodiac and studied catechism. Because that wasn't really a popular juxtaposition of intellectual endeavor in the 18th century.
Right. But Chatterton was very much admired by the people who came after. They recognized his genius. And it should be noted that Chatterton wrote his first noted poem at the age of 11.
There you go.
Yeah. So next we have a favorite, a real romantic, the man, John Keats.
Yeah. And we're going to start with reading Ode on a Grecian Urn. But it's interesting to think, as sort of well-read or widely read as John Keats is, that he was an orphan. He had little formal education, although is renowned as a poet. Both his parents died when he was young. He tried to nurse and raise his brother, who then died of tuberculosis. Whoever took charge of him basically took all his money, so he was unable to marry. So as he was young, his life was really hard. And his poetry romanticized many of those characteristics of just how hard life was as a human being. You know, the sort of frailty, the temporal nature of things, of living, life and love. So it's really interesting, young, that he could write, not necessarily from a lot of personal experience, but certainly from thinking about experiences that impacted his life. So we're going to start with Ode on a Grecian Urn. Okay, thou shall unravish bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme. What leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape, deities or mortals, or of both, in Tempe or the dales of Arcady? What men or gods are these? What maidens loath? What mad pursuit? What struggled to escape? What pipes and timbrels? What wild ecstasy? Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on.
Not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth beneath the trees, thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever can those trees be bare. Bold lover, never, never canst thou kiss, though winning near the goal, yet do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not my bliss. Forever wilt thou love, and she be fair. Ah, happy, happy boughs, that cannot shed your leaves, nor ever bid the spring adieu, and happy melodies unwearied, forever piping songs, forever new, more happy love, more happy, happy love.
Forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing human passion far above that leaves a heart high sorrowful and cloyed, a burning forehead and a parching tongue. Who are these coming to the sacrifice?
To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadst thou that heifer lowing at the skies and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore or mountain built with peaceful citadel is emptied of this folk, this pious morn? And little town, thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return.
O attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed, thou silent form dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity, cold pastoral. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye need know on earth and all ye need to know.
That is justifiably beloved, famous. And I think another note about Keats is that he trained to be a doctor. He actually did qualify to be an apothecary, but early on in his career, he told his guardian that he wanted to be a poet, not a surgeon. He didn't. Surgeons, again, are taking things away, and he's just putting things in.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's hard to place yourself in the life and times of someone in past centuries because there's so much of the fabric of our society we take for granted. I mean, it's not just cell phones and contemporary electronics, but the nature of family or familial relationships or opportunities available to, I mean, the whole class structure. It's just so different. But it's so interesting that someone young with, a background fraught with challenges found opportunity to find a voice. And it's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautiful.
And I think that, he was just such a master. He has a light touch, but then he writes, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. And we're still saying that. And 500 years from now, we'll say it as well.
Well, in that, where's that phrase, that forever young,
yeah.
Forever young. I mean, that's, you think about that sort of mental model and stories, Barry's Peter Pan, or songs or lyrics, it's just, what does that mean? What does that mean to be immortal?
Well, speaking of immortality, Keats was really a master at the ode, and here's his other really famous ode. This is Ode to a Nightingale by John Keats. My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed, and Lethe wards had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees in some melodious plot of beechen green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease.
Oh, for a draught of vintage that hath been cooled a long age in the deep delved earth, tasting of flora and the country green, dance and Provençal song and sunburned mirth. Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south, full of the true, the blushful hippocrene with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple-stained mouth, that I might drink and leave the world unseen and with thee fade away into the forest dim.
Fade far away, dissolve, and quite forget what thou among the leaves hast never known, the weariness, the fever, and the fret. Mm-hmm. Here, where men sit and hear each other groan, where palsy shakes a few sad last gray hairs, where youth grows pale and specter thin and dies. Where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed despairs, where beauty cannot keep her lustrous eyes or new love pine at them beyond tomorrow.
Away, away, for I will fly to thee, not charioted by Bacchus and his pards, but on the viewless wings of poesy. Though the dull-brained perplexes and retards, already with thee, tender is the night. And happily the queen moon is on her throne, clustered around by all her starry fays. But here there is no light, save what from heaven is with the breezes blown through verdurous glooms and winding mossy ways.
I cannot see what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs, but in embalmed darkness guess each sweet, wherewith the seasonable month endows the grass, the thicket, and the fruit tree wild, white hawthorn and the pastoral eglantine, fast fading violets covered up in leaves, and mid-May's eldest child, the coming musk rose, full of dewy wine, the murmurous haunt of flies on summer's eves.
Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme to take into the air my quiet breath. Now more than ever seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain to thy high requiem become a sod.
Thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. No hungry generations tread thee down. The voice I hear this passing night was heard in ancient days by emperor and clown. Perhaps the selfsame song that found a path through the sad heart of Ruth, when, sick for home, she stood in tears amid the alien cum, the same that oft-times hath charmed magic casements, opening on the foam of perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn.
Forlorn, the very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. Adieu, the fancy cannot cheat so well as she is famed to do, deceiving elf. Adieu, adieu, thy plaintive anthem fades past the near meadows, over the still stream, up the hillside, and now 'tis buried deep in the next valley glades. Was it a vision or a waking dream? Fled is that music. Do I wake or sleep?
That is an amazing poem.
Whoa. About a bird. So.
And
so,
everything else.
And everything else.
Yes.
Every word, forlorn. The very word is like a bell. Oh, my gosh.
To toll me back from thee to my soul self. I mean, no one was really doing this. They were sitting in the woods and listening to a bird and having, you know, all the tension between the I yearn for death, I think about death, I ache for death, and then to the bird, thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. No hungry generations tread thee down. The voice I heard was, goes back to Roman times. I mean, just the level of education, but also synthesis and understanding. I think the longer I stay on the planet, I mean, the more honor I want to pay to poets, because they really encapsulate. The people who write poetry, that is what lasts.
Yeah, well, and it's moving because it's the use of language is so evocative. There's a story, but then there are stories in the story. The words have, I don't want to say they have different meanings, but they mean differently as you interpret them in the context or in the whole. And, of course, the phrase, tender is the night.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa. I mean, that's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in this around the viewless wings of poesy and the queen mother, the moon, queen moon, I mean, is on her throne. This is just so rich. There's so much to pull out of his poetry. I could read it several times over, and it generates something different when I'm thinking about it and then reacting.
And you know, that's the genius here. So we're going to conclude our John Keats poems with a short one, which I will read. It is called "Bright Star, Would I Were Steadfast as Thou Art." Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendor hung aloft the night, and watching with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient, sleepless eremite, the moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores, or gazing on the new soft-fallen mask of snow upon the mountains and the moors. No, yet still steadfast, still unchangeable, pillowed upon my fair love's ripening breast, to feel forever its soft fall and swell, awake forever in a sweet unrest. Still, still to hear her tender taken breath, and so live ever, or else swoon to death. So you've been listening to poems by John Keats, and we've really been in the 19th century, but we're actually going to move forward to a poet named County Cullen. And Paula, you found County Cullen.
Yeah, so, you know, thinking about young people writing poetry and the time and place that they lived and the experiences they brought forward to their writing. So County Cullen was American, novelist, and very well known in writing during the Harlem Renaissance. And again, his life was, he had some challenges in his life. He was born, and his name was County Porter. And his parents, he was brought to Harlem when he was nine by a paternal grandmother who cared for him. And he was then adopted by a minister and his wife, Reverend Frederick Cullen, in Harlem, and who he, Reverend Cullen, became the president of the Harlem chapter of the NAACP. So County Cullen went to high school, was brilliant, graduating with honors in Latin, Greek, French, and math, was engaged with New York University in Harlem, and I'm sorry, Harvard, and wrote poetry. I mean, he was young and a poet. And it was kind of a beautiful thing. And again, very active in the Harlem Renaissance. So we have a poem, and related as we were looking, researching today's body of work, he wrote a poem entitled "To John Keats, Poet at Springtime," which we thought was a nice connection to centuries past. Shall I read this, Sally? What do you think? You want to read this?
Yeah, let me read the first. I'll read the first stanza, and then you can read the second stanza, and then there is a third stanza and a fourth stanza. So we're gonna alternate this.
Okay.
So we're reading as we go. All right. To John Keats, Poet at Springtime, by County Cullen. I cannot hold my peace, John Keats. There never was a spring like this. It is an echo that repeats my last year's song and next year's bliss. I know, in spite of all men say of beauty, you have felt her most. Yea, even in your grave her way is laid, poor, troubled, lyric ghost. Spring never was so fair and dear as beauty makes her seem this year.
I cannot hold my peace, John Keats. I am as helpless in the toil of spring as any lamb that bleats to feel the solid earth recoil beneath his puny legs. Spring beats her tocsin call to those who love her, and lo, the dogwood petals cover her breast with drifts of snow, and sleek white gulls screaming to her and hover about her shoulders and kiss her cheek, while white and purple lilacs muster a strength that bears them to a cluster of color and odor. For her sake, all things that slept are now awake.
And you and I, shall we lie still, John Keats, while beauty summons us? Somehow I feel your sensitive will is pulsing up some tremulous sap, road of a maple tree whose leaves grow music as they grow, since your wild voice is in them, a harp that grieves for life, that opens death's dark door. Though dust, your fingers still can push the vision splendid to a birth, though now they work as grass in the hush of the night on the broad, sweet page of the earth.
John Keats is dead, they say, but I, who hear your full, insistent cry in bud and blossom, leaf and tree, know John Keats still writes poetry. And while my head is earthward bowed to read new life sprung from your shroud, folks seeing me must think it strange that merely spring should so derange my mind. They do not know that you, John Keats, kept revel with me too.
I love that.
I am so on board with this. We are actually taping in February, which is Black History Month, and I'm very glad that we're doing County Cullen. And we learn so much about him as a poet as he considers the work of John Keats and how much influence it's there. And these stanzas that begin with, "I cannot hold my peace, John Keats," I'm getting inarticulate while I'm reading, talking about something very articulate, but "though dust, your fingers still can push the vision splendid to a birth." There's so much respect in this. Like,
yeah,
poets,
yeah.
You know, poets respect one another. Like, the real poets I know and have worked with, they are so admiring of the people that came before. And I've seen the same thing in chess. At some point, my uncle George Marijanian will join us, and he's the executive director of the Wachusett Chess Club, and he admires a chess game that makes no sense to me. But it's the same bits of language. I think that what Cullen does is he also has this light touch, but then he has so much humor that merely spring should so derange my mind. Yeah. They do not know that you, John Keats, keep revel with me too.
Yeah, yeah.
And he writes of the period too, like to use the word revel like that. What's amazing about Shakespeare, once you get into it, is that no one could write like this. And you get it, once you get into the world of the language and the arcane vocabulary and then the sprightliness of tone, you know, you're captivated.
Yeah. Well, sprightliness of tone, and even going back looking at some of the stanzas in the Keats poems, they're serious and they're written in a time when language was much more formal and structured. But there's that sense of, you know, this life is impermanent. But wow, there's all this stuff happening. You know, it's beautiful. There's birds, you know, white gulls fly screaming, hover about her shoulders, kiss her cheek. I mean, it's the language is beautiful, personal, and not all like dour. It's not all sad and depressing. And even when in this poem, when he speaks that John Keats is dead, but not so much. His poetry isn't.
Right.
His poetry isn't.
No, it isn't. And though I feel like we need to bring this poet to a greater audience, the next poet and our final poet in our show is remarkable. A true poetry prodigy, Amanda Gorman, born in 1998 and came to national attention by reading her own poem, "The Hill We Climb," at the inauguration of Joe Biden. And I don't know about you, Paula, but I was completely unprepared for watching this young woman with her, you know, the bright yellow jacket, the you know, total radiance of her presentation, and then like the lyricism of her verse. And you have brought in a piece that we're going to really do an excerpt, because this is an educational program, and we're very much, as educators, we're very dedicated to, you know, enlarging everyone's scope.
Yeah, and there's, there are so many young poets, contemporary poets, that bring a very different voice to this work. And I think about song lyrics, hip-hop, Eminem. I mean, there are, and I, it's just remarkable to me that the social times are so compelling in different ways now for young poets. And Amanda Gorman reading at the inauguration, I think, opened all kinds of doors and provided all kinds of insight into just how important this work, poetry, can be in terms of storytelling, but really allowing different stories to be told in very different ways. So when I found this poem, and I thought, and of course it's in relation, it's called In This Place, An American Lyric, and it's an original poem written for the inaugural reading of poet laureate Tracy K. Smith, who you and I had a chance to actually hear read her poetry in Cambridge about a year ago. She's teaching at Harvard. So it's sort of the light is shining on contemporary young poets, but in a whole variety of ways. So we can start with some excerpts from In This Place, An American Lyric. From the first stanza, there's a poem in this place. In the footfalls, in the halls, in the quiet beat of the seats, it is here at the curtain of days where America writes a lyric you must whisper to say.
There's a poem in this place, in the heavy grace, the lined face of this noble building, collections burned and reborn twice. There's a poem in Boston's Copley Square where protest chants tear through the air like sheets of rain.
And then she goes on to describe a poem in a number of places, some of which have been fraught with issues around social justice, Texas, Florida, in California. And one of her stanzas read, how could this not be her city, su nacion, our country, our American lyric to write, a poem by the people. And then further on, how she writes, tyrants fear the poet. Now that we know it, we can't blow it, we owe it to show it. And then further, hope, we must bestow it like a wick in the poet so it can grow lit, bringing with it stories to rewrite. There's a poem in this place, a poem in America, a poet in every American. There's a place where this poem dwells. It is here, it is now. In the yellow song of dawn's bell, where we write an American lyric, we are just beginning to tell. Just remarkable.
Truly, truly remarkable. And again, you have been listening to a poet, I guess, prodigies of poetry, starting in the 1700s, taking us to the present day. Thank you, Paula, for a really wonderful reading and a great theme. We are very open to poetry themes and, of course, poets. The best way to get in touch with us, you can email sallycragen@gmail.com, and I'll make sure that Paula and I read it. Go to Creative Writing New England at Facebook. Or just reach out to FATV. They're very good about getting in touch. We'd like to thank my brother Hal Cragen for his great theme music. Also FATV, the greatest local music, I'm sorry, local cable access station ever. And until the next time, this is Poetry Podcast with
Paula
and Sally. Thanks
thank
for
you
listening.
Everyone.